welcome to City Watch on WBAI, here to start your day with news and insight about New York and the world around us. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons. My co-host, David Brand, is off today. Each week, David and I strive to bring you perspective from those who shape our city, the elected officials and policymakers, but also the experts and influencers and even everyday people that keep New York City moving ahead. We have had an exciting weekend here in New York, no matter what your political affiliation is. Just the celebratory mood in the city upon the presidential election results reaffirmed why I love New York City so much. That people do come together in tough times, that we look out for each other, and that even amid a year of darkness as we cope with COVID-19, we still seek community and ways to connect with one another. The visions and even the sounds that happened right outside my window in a park across the street from here where I live in Jackson Heights, on the streets in my neighborhood, and then across the city, what I watched on television throughout the day, Times Square, for instance, it felt unifying. Now, I do have to say, one thing I was very happy to see is that through a lot of the footage and also out on the streets, even as people gathered, which always makes me anxious right now in this new world, I saw the majority of people wearing their masks. Hopefully that will continue, because at the same time we're going through this political moment of change, we're also still experiencing an increase in COVID-19. So now, New York City clearly voted blue, and in fact, Queens, where I'm based, has had astronomical support for the Democratic ticket. And I did wonder over the previous few days if this would take place, given how much the results, given how much of a bubble I felt I lived in the days following the 2016 results. This election season, this year, it's been like no other. We were incredibly impressed by the nearly 100 million people across our country, and possibly the numbers are larger than what I had read, but 100 million people across the country, including 1.1 million here in our city, who voted early this year. And that's a testament to how we can increase civic engagement and participation when we provide more opportunities for people to cast their votes. And the historic ascendancy of the first female, first Black, and first South Asian vice president-elect, Senator Kamala Harris of California, to the vice presidency, that sends a message about the type of country we want for ourselves and for our futures. Now, unfortunately, the polarizing climate in our country, it continues to manifest itself with even more deaths as a result of COVID-19, mounting hunger and housing security, increased rates of substance use and stress. Now that the election is over, my hope is that government at every level will get back to governing and stabilize our economy. And that includes an immediate relief package, because many people and many businesses are suffering. COVID-19 has disproportionately impacted a number of our neighborhoods in the city, and it's been well reported that this has disproportionately impacted communities of color. The Bronx, for instance, has had its share of challenges. Amid the pandemic, employment across the country, state, and city have risen, and the Bronx has been hit hard. That is something that I will discuss with one of my guests this morning. And as COVID-19 cases increase across the country and globe, there are several warning flags in New York. The borough's percentage, Bronx's percentage of positive test results on Friday hovered around 2%. The fear now, as we head into the colder months, is that the virus will surge again. In addition to health concerns, people are worried about being able to afford to stay in their homes once the eviction moratorium in the state expires at the end of this calendar year. Hunger insecurity has increased substantially, as evidenced by the long lines in pantries. And the Bronx has been particularly vulnerable and could again become the epicenter of the epicenter, with its dense population, large number of essential workers, and high instances of those with pre-existing conditions. So today, I'll discuss these issues with three wonderful guests as I focus on the Bronx, its resilience, and what it will take to recover. And that brings me to my first guest, New York City Council Member Vanessa Gibson, who represents the Bronx's 16th Council District. As the voice of the West Bronx at City Hall, she has advocated for affordable housing, low-income families, seniors, job creation, and opportunities for youth. Councilmember Gibson is a deputy leader and chairs the Subcommittee on Capital Budget, where she helps oversee the city's capital investments, and she previously chaired the council's Public Safety Committee, earning the distinction of being both the first woman and first person of color in this position. And as chair, she had oversight of the operations and budget of the NYPD, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the District Attorney's and Special Narcotics Prosecutor, and Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice. She's a lifelong New Yorker, a proud graduate of the city's public school system, and a former New York State Assemblywoman. And she joins me this morning. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you so much, and good morning to you. Blessed Sunday.
Good morning. So before we get to the topic at hand, the Bronx, I do want to know what this weekend has been like for you as you learn that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are going to go to the White House.
I am so excited. I have been crying and praying and dancing all Saturday when I first learned that, you know, the vice president and president-elect are going to be assuming office. It is such an exciting time for Americans, as well as certainly voters in many, many states across this country, and certainly for women and women of color. It's an honor when you look at someone like Kamala Harris, all that she brings to the table, the very first in so many ways. And I think it gives so many young girls across America hope for a better tomorrow. So I am excited. I'm overjoyed. And I am looking forward to this new administration.
Obviously, there are a lot of challenges ahead. We're facing a very difficult economy, and we're also still amid COVID-19. What are your hopes for this administration, a Biden-Harris administration?
Well, as they have said, my first order of business is just the recovery of COVID-19, the pandemic, working with so many states, particularly New York State, on getting, you know, more rapid testing, on more test and tracing, and really dealing with healthcare disparities. A lot of our New Yorkers and Bronx residents died to COVID because of underlying health conditions that are all preventable. Heart disease, high blood pressure, obesity, you know, things that we can really prevent if our healthcare system was better and more accessible, as well as poor food choices. Having access to healthier food options is an essential part of this conversation. So I fundamentally believe this administration is going to tackle this head on in a very aggressive and deliberate way. We need to make sure we provide resources in communities of color who were the hardest hit and the most disproportionately hit as well.
Since I'm focusing on issues affecting the Bronx today, what do you feel is the state of the Bronx today amid the pandemic, and what are some of the pressing needs?
We've had such a setback in the Bronx, to be very honest. It's not been an easy time since March. I have been one of those elected officials out in my district almost every day, giving out food and PPE, going to food pantries, soup kitchens, you know, really trying to assure a lot of residents that we were getting through this together and that it's a challenge. A lot of people lost their lives in the Bronx, and we will never forget that. But I think, you know, this pandemic has happened for a reason. It has caused us to really look at our infrastructure around healthcare, our food access and food deserts that we live in, health disparities that we faced before COVID, during COVID, and after COVID, and how we can do better. Government has to do better. Communities of color have been hurting. Most of our residents in the Bronx are essential workers, predominantly women and women of color who have been out on the front lines every day, sacrificing themselves to protect us and going home to their families. We recognize that. The small businesses have been really impacted. So I really believe the state of the Bronx, we were very good. We were on a good trajectory at the beginning of this year, but obviously COVID has set us back. One in every four Bronx residents lost their job, their employment, their revenue, and so that has been a challenge for us. Food access, health care, and getting residents back to work are primary focuses that we have to tackle right now.
And I'm so glad that you've been touching on this about hunger insecurity. One of my former co-hosts, Joel Berg, who our listeners know, is with Hunger Freedom. Yeah, I love Joel, too. I have him back whenever possible. You know, he has talked with me about the struggle that many people have been facing. And we're heading into those colder months right now. At the same time, we're experiencing the uptick in COVID-19. What can your office do, and what can the council do, and what more generally can the public do to help those who might be facing hunger insecurity at this time?
A couple of things. So the Get Food NYC program, where residents that are 62 and older and unable to get their own food are able to apply by calling 311 each week to get food delivered to their home, supporting food pantries and soup kitchens and a lot of community providers like Food Bank, City Harvest, Fresh Direct, Common Pantry, all of these organizations that were on the front lines during the pandemic, we in the city have to support them with making sure that we expedite contracts and money for them to keep doing this work. PPE is constantly a priority, so we have to make sure we get the face masks, the hand sanitizers out. We have to keep sending the message out to people on social distancing and washing your hands. The holidays are coming up, so it's going to be a challenging time for many families that have lost income. Thanksgiving is a season of being thankful, but it's hard to be thankful when you don't feel you have a lot to be thankful for. We're grateful for life and every day we have, but a lot of families are struggling to make ends meet, to pay rent, to get food on the table, basic shelter and basic necessities. So supporting the institutions, the organizations, the community groups, the providers. I'm concerned about street homeless New Yorkers that are living on the streets. It's going to get cold soon. So all of these things we have to focus on. And as a council, we can work with the administration on expediting money and contracts and supporting these organizations. And then the test and tracing, rapid testing. You mentioned in your opening, we have an uptick in some of our zip codes in the West Bronx, and one of those is mine where I live. And so we have to go into these communities and talk to people, remind them of the importance of wearing a mask and social distancing. But also we have to encourage them to get tested frequently as much as they can. So all of these things are on our radar as we complete this year, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and holiday season. You know, we have to do more. We have to be very aggressive because I think families are struggling now more than ever.
And clearly, that struggle includes an economic struggle, and the city and borough are facing some very difficult times ahead. Likely the next budget as well is going to have to include some very difficult cuts. This may include, I would think, the capital budget, where certain initiatives may be put on hold. You are chair of the subcommittee on the capital budget. What do you envision happening?
So what we envision happening, again, this is under the assumption that we don't get the federal support we need. And I'm grateful that with the Biden-Harris administration, New York will be a priority, and that's important for us in the new year. But without that and without support from the state who's facing its own budget deficits, we're going into FY22 with a $5 billion deficit, and we have to plug that deficit, and we have to get revenue somewhere. We're not raising taxes on New York City residents, but we have to find a way to generate revenue. On the capital side, bonding capacity and making sure that we get these capital projects up and running has been a challenge because of COVID. Projects were stalled. The construction of schools, of libraries, of parks, of playgrounds, of necessary affordable housing. So a lot of that is just starting now this winter, but we are concerned that we're going to be delayed again if there's a second wave. So we've been working with the administration, with HPD, the deputy mayor, and their teams about how we can not only just provide more money in the capital, but avoid shifting it to the outer years, which is what the administration did in this adopted budget. In HPD's budget, almost $500 million was shifted to the outer years of FY23 and beyond. And we fought because affordable housing is important, not just for the economic aspect, but for the jobs and the impact it will have on MWBE firms getting those contracts. So the administration made an announcement a few weeks ago that $400 million of that is going to be put in the January plan that we will see very shortly. So we're grateful for that, but that has to happen. The federal government has to come through, not only just to avoid layoffs, but to give us the necessary bonding we need to move these capital projects and really protect our infrastructure in New York City.
So a new study just came out recently, and I saw you had weighed in on this. It recently illustrated inequities in municipal pay across racial and gender lines here in the city. What did this report, which is now required annually, what did it say to you?
Well, it unfortunately highlighted what many of us already knew, that there is a huge pay disparity when you look at African-American women, Latinas, and Asian-American women in the city workforce compared to their white male counterparts. We saw disparities as high as $8,000 per year, as low as $4,500 per year in different categories. But it reminds us of the urgent need to achieve pay parity, equal pay for equal work. And every year, you know, the Women's Caucus, I as co-chair, along with my colleagues in the Women's Caucus, the City Council, women's groups, Power New York, and others, we join together and recognize these different days because we want to highlight disparities. In a world in which women are so undervalued, particularly women of color, We have to show young girls that will join the city's workforce that they will be paid equally for equal work. And this report just highlights just one part when it looks at salary. But we also know when you look at years of experience and educational experience, there's also going to be pay and wage gaps as well in that area. So I think for us, it sets a tone for future administrations now that this is codified in law, that we are going to push and push administrations to make sure that women and women of color are paid equally and fairly in the system. It's unfair. It's insulting, particularly since the majority of women and women of color have been essential workers, frontline workers, on the ground every day during this pandemic. It's insulting that they're not paid equally for equal work.
So you are term limited, and we'll get to your future plans in just a moment, but I look at the face of the council and female representation in all elective offices in the Bronx. Out of 51 New York City Council seats, only 5 women are set to remain in office in 2021. Women are significantly underrepresented, not just within the council, but in other legislative bodies and at a state level. Why do you feel this imbalance occurs? And by the way, since we just had a major development this weekend on a national front, do you think that is going to spur more women to seek elective office?
Absolutely. Kamala's ascension of vice president is going to spur a generation of young girls, and particularly young women of color across this country, who dare to dream and dare to hope and defy the odds, and they're going to stand in their purpose. It is exciting for women, and it's our time to shine. Women have always been doing this work. We've always been on the front lines, but never recognized for it. And a lot of women struggle running for office as a candidate. Why? Because you can't raise money as a woman and a woman of color. It's hard to compete in a crowded field of men. Predominantly white men over the years have been, leading these legislative bodies. And in the city council of 51 members, there are only 12 women. At the highest level, it was 17. And now we're losing so many because of term limits. But it is time for women to step up and say, you know what? It is my time. I'm not going to sit back. I'm not going to fall back. I'm not going to wait. I am going to run, because little girls need to see themselves in their leaders. Every body of government should be reflective of the population it serves. And women are a majority of voters in New York State. Black women have come out in high numbers in all of these elections. And I think it's just time for women, African-American women, Latinas, Asian-American, Native American women to step up, because little girls are looking for leadership and they need to see the leaders that they can possibly be, like a Kamala Harris. So I truly believe, yes, this is going to create a wave of candidates that are running and are going to defy all the odds that have been stacked against them for generations.
And I've only got about 2 minutes left. I want to just have you let our listeners know what your future plans are, because you also hope to break, the glass ceiling in the Bronx. Let our listeners know what you're up to next.
I am excited as I end my second and final term in the city council. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve the residents of District 16 in the West Bronx, and before that, the residents of District 77 in the State Assembly. And I'm looking forward to announcing my candidacy for Bronx Borough President in 2021. It is time, as a borough of the Bronx, that we continue to elect qualified leaders that can take the borough to the next horizon. We've had great leadership in the Bronx with previous borough presidents, including our current borough president, but we've never had a woman and a woman of color. And not only that, but we have to make sure we recover from COVID, we get residents back to work, we deal with health disparities in our healthcare infrastructure, we protect and value small businesses, and we create jobs of tomorrow. We invest in college and careers, we break down the school-to-prison pipeline, and deal with so many issues that are confronting our younger generation. We give them hope for tomorrow, we give them hope for a better day, and we allow them a space where their voices can be heard. That is the candidate I want to be in the next Bronx Borough President, and I'm excited at this journey. I'm excited at just the opportunity to be considered, because no woman has ever been able to achieve this monumental task as Bronx Borough President. But I'm excited about the journey ahead, and I ask everyone listening to find out about the work I've done in the council, the assembly, check me out, look me up, Google me, and let's get to work.
And as I close, is there a website? Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Right. So right now, my council website is www.council.nyc.gov. I am on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Vanessa L. Gibson. And then we are launching our website in the next few weeks, Gibson 2021. And we're going to be very active on social media and run a real grassroots campaign about the work we're doing. Right now, the focus obviously is getting through these holidays season as we close this year and working in our district on PPE and food distribution and food access and testing, because we want to keep the numbers down as much as we can and avoid a second wave, because the Bronx has had a major setback with COVID, but every setback is preparation for a comeback. And we're going to come back stronger, healthier, and more vibrant than ever on behalf of the Boogie Down Bronx.
Councilmember Vanessa Gibson, thank you so much for appearing here on WBAI today.
Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon. Thank you for having me today.
So that was my conversation with New York City Councilmember Vanessa Gibson. You're listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM, also streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons. My co-host, David Brand, is off today, and I'm focusing on the Bronx. The coronavirus has threatened to erase longstanding efforts to rebuild the Bronx with new development and businesses. The economic fallout has shuttered stores, restaurants, businesses across the borough, and left thousands out of work struggling to pay rent and buy food. That brings me to my next guest, James Parrott, Director of Economic and Fiscal Policy at the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. He has more than three decades of experience in this, in New York City economic and fiscal issues, and most recently served as deputy director and chief economist of the Fiscal Policy Institute. He has served on various city and state task forces and advisory bodies, including on Governor Cuomo's Tax Reform and Fairness Commission. And he regularly analyzes the city's economy and job market and has written extensively on these topics, topics such as income inequality, city and state budgets, and on tax policies. Professor Parrott, Dr. Parrott, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Good morning. It's good to be here.
So pre-pandemic, the Bronx's jobless rate had improved significantly over the last decade. It was down to a historic low. But in a recent piece, and that's where I came across your name, a recent piece where you were quoted in the media outlet The City, you noted that the Bronx has been hit hard by the pandemic. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so it's important for people to understand that the pandemic economic effects are unlike a recession. This has had an extremely lopsided effect, hitting hardest at the face-to-face service industries like restaurants, retail, neighborhood services, and so on. These are sectors where most of the workforce is made up of persons of color. They tend to be lower paid, a high percent of entry-level workers, young workers, and so on. And the Bronx has a very high concentration of all of those categories. A lot of Bronx residents, for example, work in Manhattan restaurants that have really been affected by the fall off, and by the fact that the arts sector has not been allowed to reopen. At this point, a lot of office workers are not in Manhattan. Tourists are not in New York City. They're not in Manhattan and so on. So that has really undercut the employment opportunities that a lot of Bronx residents would otherwise be able to take advantage of.
And what's been the impact of the pandemic on the borough when it comes to the unemployment rate? How does this compare with other boroughs in the city?
So, it's long been the case that the Bronx has had the highest unemployment rate among the boroughs and, in fact, among the counties in New York State. But as you noted, before the pandemic, the unemployment rate had gotten to a fairly low level. And it had been, in the 4 to 5% range for several months before the onset of COVID-19 in New York City. As of September, the latest month that we have data from the State Labor Department, the State Labor Department's estimate is that citywide, the unemployment rate is 14%, and in the Bronx, it's 19%. However, if you look at the people who are actually unemployed in New York City, again, keep in mind that the Labor Department survey is based upon a relatively small sample of New York City residents. We have, you know, the ability in this pandemic to look at the numbers of people on a county level, on a borough level, who are actually receiving unemployment insurance. And in doing that, we see that there are over 250,000 Bronx residents who are receiving either regular state unemployment insurance or pandemic unemployment assistance. If you take that number relative to the Bronx labor force back in February, you would see that 44% of Bronx workers are currently unemployed. I think that's a more accurate reading on what the extent of unemployment is in the Bronx, 44% rather than the 19% according to the survey.
You know, it's interesting because I'm going back to my one of my previous jobs back more than 10 years ago, so between 2002 and 2010, working in the city controller's office, when I would have these conversations with our chief economist. And usually around this time of year, you know, in October, November, December, we would see the unemployment rate, you know, drop because there were seasonal hiring trends. What, you know, do you envision that we're going to see an improvement right now in our unemployment rate this time of year, or because we're amid a pandemic, you know, all bets are off, that, you know, we're not going to see that improvement that we might normally get around this time of year?
Well, undoubtedly, there's going to be, you know, some holiday-related hiring in retail stores. You know, if you look citywide and look at the retail sector overall, it's back to the point where the employment level is only down about 10% from where it was back in February. Whereas citywide, across all industries, the city is still down about 15% overall. So retail has come back a little bit better. However, there's great unevenness within the retail sector. The clothing store sector, where a lot of young people work, and, you know, listeners should keep in mind that the Bronx has the highest share of young workers of any borough. On average, young workers are about 10% of the city workforce, but in the Bronx, they're 13%. The other boroughs are around between 9 and 10%. The Bronx is at 13%. So a lot of young workers in the Bronx, you know, often find or were able to find jobs in clothing stores, you know, like the Gap and H&M and Banana Republic and all of those. Those stores have really been undercut by the pandemic. So there will be, you know, of course, less holiday-related hiring in that regard. The biggest sector of that employs lower-paid, predominantly persons of color workers, including from the Bronx, is the restaurant sector. And you know, everybody's very familiar with the current plight of the restaurant sector. They've been able to come back very slightly. You know, jobs in full-service restaurants were still down about 40%, 40 to 45% compared to February. They're doing, you know, they had a nice day yesterday. I could see a lot of people eating out. But as the weather gets colder, it's going to be harder to do. And so I wouldn't expect any sort of holiday-related rebound in restaurant employment that otherwise you might have seen related to holiday parties and catering services and so on. So it's not going to be – we're not going to get that usual sort of end-of-the-year boost in employment, unfortunately.
You've been listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons, and I'm talking with James Parrott, Director of the Economic and Fiscal Policy at the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. There was this incredibly distressing piece in the New York Times recently by a former colleague of mine, Pat McGeehan, that our economic recovery may lag behind the rest of the country. Why is that?
So, you know, I was actually the source of those numbers that Pat used in that article. And it's because of the strong presence in New York City of the arts, of retail, and of the restaurant sector, and hospitality generally, so including hotels and so on. And then the related services, you know, transportation services connected to that. So there's a nexus of sort of tourist-related industries. And restaurants is not just tourists, but you know, it's broader than that. But tourism accounts for about 25% of the business in the restaurant sector. So those industries, you know, have a large presence in New York City, and of course, tourism, you know, has been completely deflated by the pandemic. People are not traveling. Business travelers are not making those trips in person that they used to, and so on. So, and then there's a lot of restaurants and retail that services office workers in Manhattan, most of whom, you know, 85% of whom are working remotely and likely to continue working remotely for the next few months. So it's our heavy concentration in those sectors and the fact that, you know, there's not an immediate term prospect that those are going to come back that quickly over the next few months. So New York City will remain more adversely affected by the pandemic economics than most large cities in most parts of the United States.
And given the results, because we had some results finally this weekend, given the results of the election, what do you envision now will take place to restore our economy?
Well, I'm really looking forward to having a coherent, sensible national strategy to get the coronavirus under control. That's clearly a prerequisite for economic recovery. It's not just a matter of lifting social restrictions on allowing businesses to reopen. If consumers and people don't feel safe venturing out into public, into crowded public spaces, they're not going to do that, and that's going to restrain any economic growth. So hopefully, we'll have a coherent national strategy to do that, and hopefully that will work. Beyond that, there's a really compelling need for additional economic assistance for dislocated workers. You know, we're now in the ninth month of the pandemic. Workers are soon going to be exhausting their eligibility for unemployment insurance, and yet the jobs are not back yet. So we're going to need to look at extending unemployment benefits. We really need to do something new and additional to help small businesses. The number of small businesses that are closing is really alarming across the city. You know, we just can't allow that to continue to occur. So hopefully we'll get more meaningful and substantial economic assistance. And of course, part of that is assistance needed for state and local government budgets to prevent damaging budget cuts, which will harm the economy, harm the quality of life, and worsen the extent of unemployment if state and local government workers get laid off. And hopefully, you know, President-elect Biden will honor his commitment to build back better with proposals for Green New Deal and jobs related to climate change and if infrastructure investments. Of course, the linchpin there is, you know, who's going to end up in, which party ends up in control of the U.S. Senate, and the extent to which the Senate cooperates with the president's mandate to get the economy going again and get the coronavirus under control. So you know, it's very positive that we will have a president-elect Biden, because it's more certain that the coronavirus is going to get under control. But in terms of the economic rebuilding that needs to take place, that really requires the cooperation of the Senate.
And as we look ahead, what, going back to the Bronx, what is the path out of poverty, particularly amid the pandemic? What is the path out of poverty, not just for the Bronx, but for the city and for the country?
Well, part of it hinges on making sure that we have a workforce that's adequately prepared and trained for the jobs that are going to be there. The pandemic accelerated the transition in the retail industry, for example, to e-commerce. Since the retail industry is the largest employer of lower wage and entry-level workers in New York City, we need to retool our workforce development approaches to make sure that that same category of the workforce can get access to the skills they needed to be part of the shift toward e-commerce. You know, we're not giving up on brick and mortar stores, but we have to realize that there's a strong movement toward e-commerce. And New York City fortunately has a lot of startups in that area. If those grow, they're going to have needs for computer programmers, people who can code, designers and marketing people. We should be training people for careers in that field as well. As well as in others, and I think, it makes a lot of sense for the city to continue to invest, and hopefully we'll get the state to invest more in the community college system and in CUNY, because we need to make sure that young people are getting better education and the job training that they need in order to provide those jobs that will be there in the future.
And you've done a good amount of research on the impact of COVID-19 on the economy. Where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your work?
So these reports are on the website of the Center for New York City Affairs, and it's the website is www.centernyc, .org. Once you go to that website and then look for the COVID-19 economic impact page, and you'll find all of our reports and economic updates.
Dr. James Parrott, thank you so much for joining me here on WBAI this morning.
Thank you, Jeff.
So you've been listening to City Watch, streaming live at WBAI.org and also at WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Simmons. I was just talking with James Parrott, Director for Economic and Fiscal Policy at the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School, about the impact of COVID-19 on the economy of the Bronx and more broadly what we're expecting under a Biden-Harris administration. We're going to get to the last guest in just a minute or two, but I do want to take a moment and thank you for tuning in this morning to WBAI or to any program here on WBAI. And if you if BAI is part of your life and has been for some time, whether it's this show or any other show that you make a point of tuning into each week, I ask you to just take a moment and support our fundraising drive. We're raising money to pay, for instance, for a WBAI transmitter that we rented for Times Square to keep us on the air, but also to sustain our programming. We've been around for 60 years. We want to be around for 60 more. So there are multiple ways you can support us. Obviously, it's all with a type of donation, but I'm what's called a BAI buddy. That means I give a contribution every single month, goes right onto my credit card. You can give $10, $15, $20. Most people give about $15 a month. Remember, it's tax deductible. You get you can also get, for a $35 donation, a BAI face mask. I got two of them in addition to being a BAI buddy. It just shows your support for non-commercial, non-corporate, community progressive radio by doing this. So grab a pen or get ready to type this down. Here are the ways to be able to contribute to BAI. Go online to give to, and that's the number two, give to WBAI.org, or call our call center, 516-620-3602. One more time, 516-620-3602. 3602. And if you want to be a BAI buddy, just let them know and make sure you do it in the name of whichever program you enjoy listening to. I'd love it if you could do it in the name of City Watch, but you could frankly do it for any of the programs here at BAI because we are all a community here. So, let me get to my final guest today, Dr. Vincent Galamo Ramos, a professor at New York University, director of the NYU Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health. He is duly licensed as a primary care and psychiatric nurse practitioner in New York State. He is board certified as an HIV specialist by the American Academy of HIV Medicine. His research and clinical practice focuses on the role of families in promoting health and well-being of adolescents and young adults, with a special focus on developing and evaluating and disseminating family-based community interventions. He serves as a member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS, as well as in a number of other roles. And Dr. Galamo Ramos was born and spent his childhood in the South Bronx, where he has conducted research for more than two decades. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for having me on today.
You know, I stopped short because you have so much on your bio. I stopped short of reading your whole bio because I really would like you, it shouldn't be me, you to talk a little more about your specialty, your work on COVID prevention as well.
Sure. So I think that's an interesting question, Jeff, because prior to March 2020, I really had no relationship to COVID. I think, nobody really did. But I have worked for 20 years in the Bronx, and as you mentioned, it's personal. My mom still lives in the Bronx, and so I spend quite a bit of time there, both personally and professionally. For more than two decades, I've worked on trying to improve life opportunities and reduce sort of health negative health outcomes among young people and their families. And I think as the first two guests have commented, the Bronx has really stood out for quite some time as being sort of a context of vulnerability, and no better place than the South Bronx, where many of the social conditions actually have really been suboptimal, inadequate, and left people with a great level of vulnerability. Since the COVID pandemic occurred and impacted New York City as the epicenter, there's no borough that stands out quite like the Bronx. The Bronx had the greatest number of cases, the greatest number of deaths and hospitalizations. And in many ways, much of the guidance that was available nationally, even in our city, it didn't quite sort of fit the sort of needs of families that are living in the Bronx. So that's really been our focus at the Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health. We're currently working on trying to increase testing for COVID. We're trying to help families that reside in the South Bronx to adopt mitigation strategies, so social distancing, hand washing, the use of masks. We're also trying to get folks the influenza vaccine and try to build some resilience against some of the secondary sequelae that are coming from COVID that Dr. Parra talked about, but I want to expand a little bit and talk about some of the psychological distress, the losses, some of the increases in depression, anxiety, the use of substances, and then also just the ongoing needs around chronic disease management, hypertension, obesity, diabetes, things like this, Jeff.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because, I mean, you've personally witnessed inequities in the area, particularly how the pandemic has affected the area. Talk more specifically about some of the impacts that the virus has had on the area.
So I think a couple of things. I think, the Bronx, overwhelmingly, and the South Bronx in particular, is primarily people of color. The Mott Haven community, where we do most of our work, about 70% of the population is Latino. I often refer to Latinos as sort of an invisible population, despite the fact that in New York City, roughly one in three people identifies as Latino. It's, not that often that we hear much about Latinos, unless we're hearing some of what has been some of the national rhetoric about the border wall, the sort of undocumented individuals coming into the country. And a lot of that has shaped societal sentiment in ways that don't really reflect the contributions of Latinos to our city and to our nation. Most Latinos are U.S. born. The Bronx is heavily populated by Latino and African-American communities. And I think some of the conditions in which families in the Bronx live, whether it be sort of the housing density, the sort of public housing, the intergenerational families, I think just the concentration, Jeff, of, you know, the virus in the community puts sort of people who live there more at risk. I've talked a bit about some of the comorbidities, but the Mott Haven in the South Bronx more broadly are sort of much higher on hypertension, diabetes, obesity. I think historical mistrust, you might sort of reframe that, Jeff, and sort of frame it as maybe how our health and social welfare systems haven't really been trustworthy in ways that have allowed communities to take advantage of the prevention and treatment. And then I would say just a lot of the miscommunication that we've heard nationally and a lot of the conflicting messaging that either has been in direct opposition or hasn't really spoke to the reality of the context in the Bronx. And so, for example, you may go to a public housing community where, you know, the household transmission rate was much higher than what was often talked about, which is community transmission. And yet when we look inside of those apartment units in that public housing, what we find is that there may be intergenerational families, many people living there, folks, as you know, Dr. Parrott was saying, essential workers who are commuting to the city that allows for many of us to be able to stay home. So these are folks who, you know, were providing food delivery, stocking shelves, working in all sorts of service professions that were still operating. But with that came additional exposure. And if you couple that with the high density of individuals living in your household, particularly intergenerational, you have older people, younger people, and if you have folks with chronic health conditions, if you have any sort of challenges in terms of accessing sort of prevention or treatment, then you're sort of, in many ways, you can see why the disparity in a place like Mott Haven occurred.
So, as I mentioned earlier, you're the founding director of the Latino Adolescent and Family Health Center at NYU. Obviously, the much of the work has changed amid COVID-19. Can you talk a little more broadly about the center and the type of work? Because, you know, there's so much that, you know, we did pre-pandemic that we've had to reprioritize. But I think that this, you know, the work of the center is making a difference in the area, and I'd love for our listeners to know more about it.
Sure. The Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health has been around for about 20 years. The first 10 years, I was a part of Columbia University, and about 10 years ago, I moved to NYU. But we are focused on families. We develop, we implement, we evaluate, and we disseminate sort of family-based interventions that are in the community that are designed to try to improve life opportunities and reduce health disparities. A lot of our work has been in the area of sexually transmitted infections and HIV, and also in preventing substance use. You know, this may be just maybe not so familiar to many of the listeners, but the Bronx is the home of the first adolescent AIDS program in the country, which is at Montefiore Medical Center. And AAP, the adolescent AIDS program, is where I provide clinical care to young people who are at risk and living with HIV. So a lot of the work that we do at CLAF has really been to try to prevent those negative outcomes, and to really do that in a way that looks at the family as being really the focal point of intervention.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to touch on HIV and AIDS. Amid the pandemic, people with pre-existing health conditions have been considered among the more vulnerable. What parallels have you seen among the pandemic and the AIDS epidemic, and also the response to address people's health care needs?
Sure. I mean, I think there are many parallels. I would say that, you know, often sort of scholarly folks just talk about this as being a syndemic. And what that means is multiple epidemics that sort of come together, and they sort of repeatedly impact the same populations over and over again. And I think what's important is that we need to think about not just personal sort of behaviors or choices as being at the root of why certain communities have the disparities, but really are there systems that often are actually quite ubiquitous. They're not obvious to us. They're part of the everyday fabric of our society that actually privilege some and make things harder for others. And I think the Bronx is certainly an example of this. And so, you know, what HIV and coronavirus and any of the other things that we could talk about, whether it be STIs or, you know, the fact that in Mott Haven you have, you know, some of the highest rates of opioid overdose, STI burden, reportable STIs in the South Bronx much higher, particularly among youth. And I could go down a list of things that in no way diminish the progress that's been made, but also highlight that we still have challenges. A lot of those things come together because at their core are the same sort of social sort of vulnerabilities that actually leave families sort of exposed.
You just mentioned challenges, and I had seen, I had read in one interview with you that you talked about that the extent of the HIV epidemic among Latino communities has been largely invisible. Can you just talk about that in our final few minutes?
You know, it's interesting, Jeff, because I don't want in any way suggest that we haven't made tremendous progress in our sort of ending the HIV epidemic. Our governor, Governor Cuomo, has done a terrific job. The city's done a great job. The country, starting with President Obama, who established the first national plan, and continuing up until now, even President Trump. I think that what is less spoken about is that despite the fact that we've made lots of progress, that we see that the percent change in new infections has been actually going up in the Latino community. And when we think about certain key populations, like young men who have sex with men, Black and Latino, ages 25 to 34, we see dramatic increases in sort of HIV infections. And so, you know, I think there's work that needs to happen. We haven't gotten some of our most effective prevention tools. We have something, Jeff, called PrEP, which is a once-a-day pill that blocks the virus in most people very, very effectively. And yet the pill is not, an HIV prevention pill is not available or hasn't been, better way to put it, hasn't been picked up by the communities most, you know, in need. And so when we think about who's receiving the HIV prevention pill, it's primarily white communities. When we think about the new diagnoses, which really are another way of thinking about where the greatest risk is, we see that the uptake of the HIV prevention pill has been much less. And so that's just a concrete example of, despite the progress we've made, we still have a lot of work to do. And the Bronx stands out as being one of the geographic areas where that work needs to continue.
And as I close, if people want to know more about the Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health and about your work, where should they go?
So they can check us out at claf.org, or for Mothaven, saferhaven.org, or they can just look me up at nyu.edu.
Dr. Vincent Galamo Ramos, thank you so much for being with me here on WBAI this morning.
Thank you very much, Seth. Have a good day, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So as I get ready to close the show in just a minute or two, I do want to thank our listeners again for tuning in. And if you did not catch that number before, if you'd like to make a contribution on this beautiful day, do something beautiful. Contribute to WBAI and then go out and enjoy the good weather. Go online to give to, that's the number two, WBAI.org. Give to WBAI.org. Also, again, $35. Donate that. Get a face mask. Ask for a face mask. I got two. I mean, because remember, you're not supposed to just wear the same face mask all the time. I've got five different ones, and I rotate them because you're supposed to wash them as well. And I'm learning how to do that. You can even just do it in cold water. Just make sure to wash your face masks. Give to WBAI.org or call. Call one of our operators, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. I thank you for tuning in this morning. I also want to thank my three wonderful guests as I focused on the Bronx today, starting with New York City Council member Vanessa Gibson, who today talked about her campaign that she's going to announce and have a website in the next week or two for Bronx Borough President. Also, James Parrott, PhD, Director of Economic and Fiscal Policy at the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. And as you just heard a few moments ago, Dr. Vincent Galamo Ramos, professor at NYU, where he serves as the director of the NYU Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health. I also want to thank my colleague, Sean Rhodes, engineer extraordinaire, who makes the show happen each week. So next Sunday, I believe we are off. I'll double check on that. But then next time you hear our show, it'll be David Brand with you. And I will be back I think we're on next week. No, he's on next week. I'll be back on the 22nd focusing on immigrant arts. But also, tune in to Driving Forces Thursdays at 5 o'clock. The phone lines lit up this past Thursday as we talked about the election. I'm going to do the same thing this coming Thursday. Maybe have one special guest, but largely have those phone lines open for our listeners to call because you've got a lot on your mind, and I want you to be able to express them on WBAI. Again, I thank you so much for tuning in today. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
As we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
Hello, I'm Max Schmid, member of the WBAI Local Station Board, which is the Pacifica Foundation Board, which advises local management and operations. The next meeting of the local station board will be Wednesday, November 11th at 7 p.m. Because of coronavirus precautions and restrictions, the meeting will be a remote access meeting, which will be accessible to the public. It will include an opportunity for public comment. This meeting will be the first meeting after Tuesday's national election, for whatever that may mean. Again, that's Wednesday, November 11th at 7 p.m. The meeting, held through the Zoom remote meeting service, can be accessed by calling, in the U.S., 929-205-6099 and entering the meeting ID 922.457.2995. The telephone number to call is 929-205-6099, and the meeting ID is 922.457.2995. A link to instructions, including for listening over the web and how to submit written comments, will be available through WBAI's main webpage. If you miss an LSB meeting, you can listen to it afterwards through the Pacifica posting. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but why not?
I'm Anat Gerstein from Anat Gerstein, Inc. Helping nonprofits is what we do. Nonprofits are working in overdrive to respond to the pandemic. They're running homeless shelters, providing health and mental health services, caring for kids in foster care and homebound seniors and those who are hungry and much more. They're also delivering educational entertaining content straight to our homes, and they're doing it all with less. So let's come together to support nonprofits today. Look for the hashtag support nonprofits on social media to learn more.
I love New York.
We love New York.
We've been stuck inside our homes
while our everyday heroes have been working overtime
for New York to reopen
and stay open.
We all need to do our part
and show that we care.
Look, man,
I wear a mask to protect you.
You wear a mask to protect me.
Let's all wear a mask
to stop the spread of coronavirus
and save lives.
When we show up in a mask,
we're showing up for each other.
Show your love for New York.
Because New York loves you.
You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
My name is Bill Samuels, founder of NYPeoplesConvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered.